3. The Goal of a New World Order. November 28, 1931. Fellow believers in the faith of Baha'u'llah, the inexorable march of recent events has carried humanity so near to the goal foreshadowed by Baha'u'llah that no responsible follower of his faith, viewing on all sides the distressing evidences of the world's travail, can remain unmoved at the thought of its approaching deliverance. It would not seem inappropriate, at a time when we are commemorating the world over the termination of the first decade since Abdu'l-Bahá's sudden removal from our midst, to ponder, in the light of the teachings bequeathed by him to the world, such events as have tended to hasten the gradual emergence of the world order anticipated by Baha'u'llah. 10 years ago, this very day, there flashed upon the world the news of the passing of him who alone, through the ennobling influence of his love, strength, and wisdom, could have proved its stay and solace in the many afflictions it was destined to suffer. How well we, the little band of his avowed supporters, who lay claim to have recognized the light that shone within him, can still remember his repeated allusions in the evening of his earthly life to the tribulation and turmoil with which an unregenerate humanity was to be increasingly afflicted. How poignantly some of us can recall his pregnant remarks in the presence of the pilgrims and visitors who thronged his doors on the morrow of the jubilant celebrations that greeted the termination of the World War, a war which, by the horrors it evoked, the losses it entailed, and the complications it engendered, was destined to exert so far-reaching an influence on the fortunes of mankind. How serenely, yet how powerfully, he stressed the cruel deception which a pact hailed by people and nations as the embodiment of triumphant justice and the unfailing instrument of an abiding peace held in store for an unrepentant humanity. Peace, peace, how often we heard him remark, the lips of potentates and peoples unceasingly proclaim, whereas the fire of unquenched hatreds still smoulders in their hearts. How often we heard him raise his voice whilst the tumult of triumphant enthusiasm was still at its height, and long before the faintest misgivings could have been felt or expressed, confidently declaring that the document extolled as the charter of a liberated humanity contained within itself seeds of such bitter deception as would further enslave the world. How abundant are now the evidences that attest the perspicacity of his unerring judgment. 10 years of unceasing turmoil, so laden with anguish, so fraught with incalculable consequences to the future of civilization, have brought the world to the verge of a calamity too awful to contemplate. Sad indeed is the contrast between the manifestations of confident enthusiasm in which the plenipotentiaries at Versailles so freely indulged, and the cry of unconcealed distress which victors and vanquished alike are now raising in the hour of bitter delusion. A war-weary world. Neither the force which the framers and guarantors of the peace treaties have mustered, nor the lofty ideals which originally animated the author of the Covenant of the League of Nations, have proved a sufficient bulwark against the forces of internal disruption with which a structure so laboriously contrived had been consistently assailed. neither the provisions of the so-called settlement, which the victorious powers have sought to impose, nor the machinery of an institution which America's illustrious and far-seeing president had conceived, have proved either in conception or practice adequate instruments to ensure the integrity of the order they had striven to establish. "The ills from which the world now suffers," wrote Abdu'l-Bahá in January 1920, "will multiply. The gloom which envelops it will deepen. The Balkans will remain discontented. Its restlessness will increase. The vanquished powers will continue to agitate. They will resort to every measure that may rekindle the flame of war. Movements newborn and worldwide in their range will exert their utmost effort for the advancement of their designs. The movement of the left will acquire great importance. Its influence will spread." Economic distress, since those words were written, together with political confusion, financial upheavals, religious restlessness, and racial animosities, seem to have conspired to add immeasurably to the burdens under which an impoverished, a war-weary world is groaning. Such has been the cumulative effect of these successive crises, following one another with such bewildering rapidity that the very foundations of society are trembling. The world, to whichever continent we turn our gaze, to however remote a region our survey may extend, is everywhere assailed by forces it can neither explain nor control. Europe, hitherto regarded as the cradle of a highly vaunted civilization, as the torchbearer of liberty and the mainspring of the forces of world, industry and commerce, stands bewildered and paralyzed at the sight of so tremendous an upheaval. Long-cherished ideals in the political, no less than in the economic sphere of human activity, are being severely tested under the pressure of reactionary forces on the one hand and of an insidious and persistent radicalism on the other. From the heart of Asia, distant rumblings, ominous and insistent, portend the steady onslaught of a creed which, by its negation of God, his laws and principles, threatens to disrupt the foundations of human society. The clamour of a nascent nationalism, coupled with a recrudescence of scepticism and unbelief, come as added misfortunes to a continent hitherto regarded as the symbol of age-long stability and undisturbed resignation. From darkest Africa, the first stirrings of a conscious and determined revolt against the aims and methods of political and economic imperialism can be increasingly discerned, adding their share to the growing vicissitudes of a troubled age. Not even America, which until very recently prided itself on its traditional policy of aloofness and the self-contained character of its economy, the invulnerability of its institutions and the evidences of its growing prosperity and prestige, has been able to resist the impelling forces that have swept her into the vortex of an economic hurricane that now threatens to impair the basis of her own industrial and economic life. Even faraway Australia, which owing to its remoteness from the storm centres of Europe would have been expected to be immune from the trials and torments of an ailing continent, has been caught in this whirlpool of passion and strife, impotent to extricate herself from their ensnaring influence. The signs of impending chaos. Never, indeed, have there been such widespread and basic upheavals, whether in the social, economic, or political spheres of human activity, as those now going on in different parts of the world. Never have there been so many and varied sources of danger as those that now threaten the structure of society. The following words of Baha'u'llah are indeed significant as we pause to reflect upon the present state of a strangely disordered world. How long will humanity persist in its waywardness? How long will injustice continue? How long is chaos and confusion to reign amongst men? How long will discord agitate the face of society? The winds of despair are, alas, blowing from every direction, and the strife that divides and afflicts the human race is daily increasing. The signs of impending convulsions and chaos can now be discerned, inasmuch as the prevailing order appears to be lamentably defective. The disquieting influence of over 30 million souls living under minority conditions throughout the continent of Europe. The vast and ever-swelling army of the unemployed, with its crushing burden and demoralizing influence on governments and people. The wicked, unbridled race of armaments swallowing an ever-increasing share of the substance of already impoverished nations. The utter demoralization from which the international financial markets are now increasingly suffering. The onslaught of secularism invading what has hitherto been regarded as the impregnable strongholds of Christian and Muslim orthodoxy. These stand out as the gravest symptoms that bode ill for the future stability of the structure of modern civilization. Little wonder if one of Europe's preeminent thinkers, honoured for his wisdom and restraint, should have been forced to make so bold an assertion. The world is passing through the gravest crisis in the history of civilization. We stand, writes another, before either a world catastrophe or perhaps before the dawn of a greater era of truth and wisdom. It is in such times, he adds, that religions have perished and are born. Might we not already discern, as we scan the political horizon, the alignment of those forces that are dividing afresh the continent of Europe into camps of potential combatants, determined upon a contest that may mark, unlike the last war, the end of an epoch, a vast epoch, in the history of human evolution? Are we the privileged custodians of a priceless faith, called upon to witness a cataclysmical change, politically as fundamental and spiritually as beneficent as that which precipitated the fall of the Roman Empire in the West? Might it not happen, every vigilant adherent of the faith of Baha'u'llah might well pause to reflect, that out of this world eruption there may stream forces of such spiritual energy as shall recall, nay, eclipse, the splendour of those signs and wonders that accompanied the establishment of the faith of Jesus Christ? Might there not emerge, out of the agony of a shaken world, a religious revival of such scope and power as to even transcend the potency of those world-directing forces with which the religions of the past have, at fixed intervals and according to an inscrutable wisdom, revived the fortunes of declining ages and peoples? Might not the bankruptcy of this present, this highly vaunted materialistic civilization, in itself clear away the choking weeds that now hinder the unfoldment and future efflorescence of God's struggling faith? Let Baha'u'llah himself shed the illumination of his words upon our path as we steer our course amid the pitfalls and miseries of this troubled age. More than 50 years ago, in a world far removed from the ills and trials that now torment it, there flowed from his pen these prophetic words. The world is in travail, and its agitation waxeth day by day. Its face is turned towards waywardness and unbelief. Such shall be its plight, that to disclose it now would not be meet and seemly. Its perversity will long continue. And when the appointed hour is come, there shall suddenly appear that which shall cause the limbs of mankind to quake. Then, and only then, will the divine standard be unfurled and the nightingale of paradise warble its melody. The impotence of statesmanship. Dearly beloved friends, humanity, whether viewed in the light of man's individual conduct or in the existing relationships between organized communities and nations, has, alas, strayed too far and suffered too great a decline to be redeemed through the unaided efforts of the best among its recognized rulers and statesmen, however disinterested their motives, however concerted their action, however unsparing in their zeal and devotion to its cause. No scheme which the calculations of the highest statesmanship may yet devise, no doctrine which the most distinguished exponents of economic theory may hope to advance, no principle which the most ardent of moralists may strive to inculcate, can provide in the last resort adequate foundations upon which the future of a distracted world can be built. No appeal for mutual tolerance which the worldly wise may raise, however compelling and insistent, can calm its passions or help restore its vigour. Nor would any general scheme of mere organized international cooperation in whatever sphere of human activity, however ingenious in conception or extensive in scope, succeed in removing the root cause of the evil that has so rudely upset the equilibrium of present-day society. Not even, I venture to assert, would the very act of devising the machinery required for the political and economic unification of the world, a principle that has been increasingly advocated in recent times, provide in itself the antidote against the poison that is steadily undermining the vigour of organized peoples and nations. What else might we not confidently affirm but the unreserved acceptance of the divine programme enunciated with such simplicity and force as far back as 60 years ago by Baha'u'llah, embodying in its essentials God's divinely appointed scheme for the unification of mankind in this age, coupled with an indomitable conviction in the unfailing efficacy of each and all of its provisions, is eventually capable of withstanding the forces of internal disintegration, which, if unchecked, must needs continue to eat into the vitals of a despairing society. It is towards this goal, the goal of a new world order, divine in origin, all-embracing in scope, equitable in principle, challenging in its features, that a harassed humanity must strive. To claim to have grasped all the implications of Baha'u'llah's prodigious scheme for worldwide human solidarity, or to have fathomed its import, would be presumptuous on the part of even the declared supporters of his faith. To attempt to visualize in all its possibilities, to estimate its future benefits, to picture its glory, would be premature at even so advanced a stage in the evolution of mankind. The Guiding Principles of World Order. All we can reasonably venture to attempt is to strive to obtain a glimpse of the first streaks of the promised dawn that must, in the fullness of time, chase away the gloom that has encircled humanity. All we can do is to point out in their broadest outlines what appear to us to be the guiding principles underlying the world order of Baha'u'llah, as amplified and enunciated by Abdu'l-Bahá, the centre of his covenant with all mankind and the appointed interpreter and expounder of his word. That the unrest and suffering afflicting the mass of mankind are in no small measure the direct consequences of the world war, and are attributable to the unwisdom and short-sightedness of the framers of the peace treaties, only a biased mind can refuse to admit. That the financial obligations contracted in the course of the war, as well as the imposition of a staggering burden of reparations upon the vanquished, have to a very great extent been responsible for the maldistribution and the consequent shortage of the world's monetary gold supply, which, in turn, has to a very great measure accentuated the phenomenal fall in prices and thereby relentlessly increased the burdens of impoverished countries, no impartial mind would question. That intergovernmental debts have imposed a severe strain on the masses of the people in Europe, have upset the equilibrium of national budgets, have crippled national industries, and led to an increase in the number of the unemployed, is no less apparent to an unprejudiced observer. That the spirit of vindictiveness, of suspicion, of fear and rivalry engendered by the war, and which the provisions of the peace treaties have served to perpetuate and foster, has led to an enormous increase of national competitive armaments, involving during the last year the aggregate expenditure of no less than £1,000 million, which in turn has accentuated the effects of the worldwide depression, is a truth that even the most superficial observer will readily admit. That a narrow and brutal nationalism, which the post-war theory of self-determination has served to reinforce, has been chiefly responsible for the policy of high and prohibitive tariffs, so injurious to the healthy flow of international trade and to the mechanism of international finance, is a fact which few would venture to dispute. It would be idle, however, to contend that the war, with all the losses it involved, the passions it aroused, and the grievances it left behind, has solely been responsible for the unprecedented confusion into which almost every section of the civilized world is plunged at present. Is it not a fact, and this is the central idea I desire to emphasize, that the fundamental cause of this world unrest is attributable not so much to the consequences of what must sooner or later come to be regarded as a transitory dislocation in the affairs of a continually changing world, but rather to the failure of those into whose hands the immediate destinies of peoples and nations have been committed, to adjust their system of economic and political institutions to the imperative needs of a rapidly evolving age. Are not these intermittent crises that convulse present-day society due primarily to the lamentable inability of the world's recognized leaders to read aright the signs of the times, to rid themselves once for all of their preconceived ideas and fettering creeds, and to reshape the machinery of their respective governments according to those standards that are implicit in Baha'u'llah's supreme declaration of the oneness of mankind, the chief and distinguishing feature of the faith he proclaimed. For the principle of the oneness of mankind, the cornerstone of Baha'u'llah's world-embracing dominion, implies nothing more nor less than the enforcement of his scheme for the unification of the world, the scheme to which we have already referred. In every dispensation, writes Abdu'l-Bahá, the light of divine guidance has been focused upon one central theme. In this wondrous revelation, this glorious century, the foundation of the faith of God and the distinguishing feature of his law is the consciousness of the oneness of mankind. How pathetic indeed are the efforts of those leaders of human institutions who, in utter disregard of the spirit of the age, are striving to adjust national processes suited to the ancient days of self-contained nations to an age which must either achieve the unity of the world as adumbrated by Baha'u'llah or perish. At so critical an hour in the history of civilization, it behooves the leaders of all the nations of the world, great and small, whether in the East or in the West, whether victors or vanquished, to give heed to the clarion call of Baha'u'llah, and thoroughly imbued with a sense of world solidarity, the sine qua non of loyalty to his cause, arise manfully to carry out in its entirety the one remedial scheme he, the divine physician, has prescribed for an ailing humanity. Let them discard once for all every preconceived idea, every national prejudice, and give heed to the sublime counsel of Abdu'l-Bahá, the authorized expounder of his teachings. "You can best serve your country," was Abdu'l-Bahá's rejoinder to a high official in the service of the federal government of the United States of America, who had questioned him as to the best manner in which he could promote the interests of his government and people. "If you strive in your capacity as a citizen of the world to assist in the eventual application of the principle of federalism underlying the government of your own country to the relationships now existing between the peoples and nations of the world." In The Secret of Divine Civilization, The Mysterious Forces of Civilization, Abdu'l-Bahá's outstanding contribution to the future reorganization of the world, we read the following. "True civilization will unfurl its banner in the midmost heart of the world whenever a certain number of its distinguished and high-minded sovereigns, the shining exemplars of devotion and determination, shall, for the good and happiness of all mankind, arise with firm resolve and clear vision to establish the cause of universal peace. They must make the cause of peace the object of general consultation, and seek by every means in their power to establish a union of the nations of the world. They must conclude a binding treaty and establish a covenant, the provisions of which shall be sound, inviolable, and definite. They must proclaim it to all the world and obtain for it the sanction of all the human race. This supreme and noble undertaking, the real source of the peace and well-being of all the world, should be regarded as sacred by all that dwell on earth. All the forces of humanity must be mobilized to ensure the stability and permanence of this most great covenant. In this all-embracing pact, the limits and frontiers of each and every nation should be clearly fixed. The principles underlying the relations of governments towards one another definitely laid down, and all international agreements and obligations ascertained. In like manner, the size of the armaments of every government should be strictly limited, for if the preparations for war and the military forces of any nation should be allowed to increase, they will arouse the suspicion of others. The fundamental principle underlying this solemn pact should be so fixed that if any government later violate any one of its provisions, all the governments on earth should arise to reduce it to utter submission. Nay, the human race as a whole should resolve, with every power at its disposal, to destroy that government. Should this greatest of all remedies be applied to the sick body of the world, it will assuredly recover from its ills and will remain eternally safe and secure. A few, he further adds, unaware of the power latent in human endeavour, consider this matter as highly impracticable, nay, even beyond the scope of man's utmost efforts. Such is not the case, however. On the contrary, thanks to the unfailing grace of God, the loving kindness of his favoured ones, the unrivalled endeavours of wise and capable souls, and the thoughts and ideas of the peerless leaders of this age, nothing whatsoever can be regarded as unattainable. Endeavour, ceaseless endeavour, is required. Nothing short of an indomitable determination can possibly achieve it. Many a cause which past ages have regarded as purely visionary, yet in this day has become most easy and practicable. Why should this most great and lofty cause, the day star of the firmament of true civilization, and the cause of the glory, the advancement, the well-being and success of all humanity, be regarded as impossible of achievement? Surely the day will come when its beauteous light shall shed illumination upon the assemblage of man. Seven Lights of Unity. In one of his tablets, Abdu'l-Bahá, elucidating further his noble theme, reveals the following. In cycles gone by, though harmony was established, yet, owing to the absence of means, the unity of all mankind could not have been achieved. Continents remained widely divided, nay, even among the peoples of one and the same continent, association and interchange of thought were well nigh impossible. Consequently, intercourse, understanding, and unity amongst all the peoples and kindreds of the earth were unattainable. In this day, however, means of communication have multiplied, and the five continents of the earth have virtually merged into one. In like manner, all the members of the human family, whether peoples or governments, cities or villages, have become increasingly interdependent. For none is self-sufficiency any longer possible, inasmuch as political ties unite all peoples and nations, and the bonds of trade and industry, of agriculture and education, are being strengthened every day. Hence, the unity of all mankind can, in this day, be achieved. Verily, this is none other but one of the wonders of this wondrous age, this glorious century. Of this past ages have been deprived, for this century, the century of light, has been endowed with unique and unprecedented glory, power, and illumination. Hence, the miraculous unfolding of a fresh marvel every day. Eventually, it will be seen how bright its candles will burn in the assemblage of man. Behold how its light is now dawning upon the world's darkened horizon. The first candle is unity in the political realm, the early glimmerings of which can now be discerned. The second candle is unity of thought in world undertakings, the consummation of which will ere long be witnessed. The third candle is unity in freedom, which will surely come to pass. The fourth candle is unity in religion, which is the cornerstone of the foundation itself, and which, by the power of God, will be revealed in all its splendor. The fifth candle is the unity of nations, a unity which in this century will be securely established, causing all the peoples of the world to regard themselves as citizens of one common fatherland. The sixth candle is unity of races, making of all that dwell on earth peoples and kindreds of one race. The seventh candle is unity of language, i.e., the choice of a universal tongue in which all peoples will be instructed and converse. Each and every one of these will inevitably come to pass, inasmuch as the power of the kingdom of God will aid and assist in their realization. A world superstate. Over 60 years ago, in his tablet to Queen Victoria, Baha'u'llah, addressing the concourse of the rulers of the earth, revealed the following. Take ye counsel together, and let your concern be only for that which profiteth mankind and bettereth the condition thereof. Regard the world as the human body, which though created whole and perfect, has been afflicted through diverse causes with grave ills and maladies. Not for one day did it rest, nay, its sicknesses waxed more severe as it fell under the treatment of unskilled physicians who have spurred on the steed of their worldly desires and have erred grievously. And if at one time, through the care of an able physician, a member of that body was healed, the rest remained afflicted as before. Thus informeth you the all-knowing, the all-wise. That which the Lord hath ordained as the sovereign remedy and mightiest instrument for the healing of all the world is the union of all its peoples in one universal cause, one common faith. This can in no wise be achieved except through the power of a skilled, an all-powerful and inspired physician. This verily is the truth, and all else naught but error. In a further passage, Baha'u'llah adds these words, We see you adding every year unto your expenditures, and laying the burden thereof on the people whom ye rule. This verily is naught but grievous injustice. Fear the sighs and tears of this wronged one, and burden not your peoples beyond that which they can endure. Be reconciled among yourselves, that ye may need armaments no more save in a measure to safeguard your territories and dominions. Be united, O concourse of the sovereigns of the world. For thereby will the tempest of discord be stilled amongst you, and your peoples find rest. Should any one among you take up arms against another, rise ye all against him, for this is naught but manifest justice. What else could these weighty words signify if they did not point to the inevitable curtailment of unfettered national sovereignty as an indispensable preliminary to the formation of the future Commonwealth of all the nations of the world? Some form of a world superstate must needs be evolved, in whose favor all the nations of the world will have willingly ceded every claim to make war, certain rights to impose taxation, and all rights to maintain armaments, except for purposes of maintaining internal order within their respective dominions. Such a state will have to include within its orbit an international executive adequate to enforce supreme and unchallengeable authority on every recalcitrant member of the Commonwealth. A world parliament whose members shall be elected by the people in their respective countries and whose election shall be confirmed by their respective governments. And a supreme tribunal whose judgment will have a binding effect, even in such cases where the parties concerned did not voluntarily agree to submit their case to its consideration. A world community in which all economic barriers will have been permanently demolished, and the interdependence of capital and labor definitely recognized, in which the clamor of religious fanaticism and strife will have been forever stilled, in which the flame of racial animosity will have been finally extinguished, in which a single code of international law, the product of the considered judgment of the world's federated representatives, shall have as its sanction the instant and coercive intervention of the combined forces of the federated units. And finally, a world community in which the fury of a capricious and militant nationalism will have been transmuted into an abiding consciousness of world citizenship. Such, indeed, appears in its broadest outline the order anticipated by Baha'u'llah, an order that shall come to be regarded as the fairest fruit of a slowly maturing age. The tabernacle of unity, Baha'u'llah proclaims in his message to all mankind, has been raised. Regard ye not one another as strangers. Of one tree are all ye the fruit, and of one bough the leaves. The world is but one country, and mankind its citizens. Let not a man glory in that he loves his country. Let him rather glory in this, that he loves his kind. Unity in diversity. Let there be no misgivings as to the animating purpose of the worldwide law of Baha'u'llah. Far from aiming at the subversion of the existing foundations of society, it seeks to broaden its basis, to remould its institutions in a manner consonant with the needs of an ever-changing world. It can conflict with no legitimate allegiances, nor can it undermine essential loyalties. Its purpose is neither to stifle the flame of a sane and intelligent patriotism in men's hearts, nor to abolish the system of national autonomy so essential if the evils of excessive centralization are to be avoided. It does not ignore, nor does it attempt to suppress, the diversity of ethnical origins, of climate, of history, of language and tradition, of thought and habit that differentiate the peoples and nations of the world. It calls for a wider loyalty, for a larger aspiration than any that has animated the human race. It insists upon the subordination of national impulses and interests to the imperative claims of a unified world. It repudiates excessive centralization on one hand and disclaims all attempts at uniformity on the other. Its watchword is unity in diversity, such as Abdu'l-Bahá himself has explained. Consider the flowers of a garden. Though differing in kind, colour, form and shape, yet inasmuch as they are refreshed by the waters of one spring, revived by the breath of one wind, invigorated by the rays of one sun, this diversity increaseth their charm and addeth unto their beauty. How unpleasing to the eye, if all the flowers and plants, the leaves and blossoms, the fruit, the branches and the trees of that garden were all of the same shape and colour. Diversity of hues, form and shape enricheth and adorneth the garden and heighteneth the effect thereof. In like manner, when diverse shades of thought, temperament and character are brought together under the power and influence of one central agency, the beauty and glory of human perfection will be revealed and made manifest. Naught but the celestial potency of the Word of God, which ruleth and transcendeth the realities of all things, is capable of harmonizing the divergent thoughts, sentiments, ideas, and convictions of the children of men. The call of Baha'u'llah is primarily directed against all forms of provincialism, all insularities and prejudices. If long-cherished ideals and time-honored institutions, if certain social assumptions and religious formulae have ceased to promote the welfare of the generality of mankind, if they no longer minister to the needs of a continually evolving humanity, let them be swept away and relegated to the limbo of obsolescent and forgotten doctrines. Why should these, in a world subject to the immutable law of change and decay, be exempt from the deterioration that must needs overtake every human institution? For legal standards, political and economic theories are solely designed to safeguard the interests of humanity as a whole, and not humanity to be crucified for the preservation of the integrity of any particular law or doctrine. The principle of oneness. Let there be no mistake. The principle of the oneness of mankind, the pivot round which all the teachings of Baha'u'llah revolve, is no mere outburst of ignorant emotionalism or an expression of vague and pious hope. Its appeal is not to be merely identified with a reawakening of the spirit of brotherhood and goodwill among men, nor does it aim solely at the fostering of harmonious cooperation among individual peoples and nations. Its implications are deeper, its claims greater than any which the prophets of old were allowed to advance. Its message is applicable not only to the individual, but concerns itself primarily with the nature of those essential relationships that must bind all the states and nations as members of one human family. It does not constitute merely the enunciation of an ideal, but stands inseparably associated with an institution adequate to embody its truth, demonstrate its validity, and perpetuate its influence. It implies an organic change in the structure of present-day society, a change such as the world has not yet experienced. It constitutes a challenge, at once bold and universal, to outworn shibboleths of national creeds, creeds that have had their day and which must, in the ordinary course of events, as shaped and controlled by Providence, give way to a new gospel, fundamentally different from and infinitely superior to what the world has already conceived. It calls for no less than the reconstruction and the demilitarization of the whole civilized world, a world organically unified in all the essential aspects of its life, its political machinery, its spiritual aspiration, its trade and finance, its script and language, and yet infinite in the diversity of the national characteristics of its federated units. It represents the consummation of human evolution, an evolution that has had its earliest beginnings in the birth of family life, its subsequent development in the achievement of tribal solidarity, leading in turn to the constitution of the city-state and expanding later into the institution of independent and sovereign nations. The principle of the oneness of mankind, as proclaimed by Baha'u'llah, carries with it no more and no less than a solemn assertion that attainment to this final stage in this stupendous evolution is not only necessary, but inevitable, that its realization is fast approaching, and that nothing short of a power that is born of God can succeed in establishing it. So marvelous a conception finds its earliest manifestations in the efforts consciously exerted and the modest beginnings already achieved by the declared adherents of the faith of Baha'u'llah, who, conscious of the sublimity of their calling and initiated into the ennobling principles of his administration, are forging ahead to establish his kingdom on this earth. It has its indirect manifestations in the gradual diffusion of the spirit of world solidarity, which is spontaneously arising out of the welter of a disorganized society. It would be stimulating to follow the history of the growth and development of this lofty conception, which must increasingly engage the attention of the responsible custodians of the destinies of peoples and nations. To the states and principalities just emerging from the welter of the great Napoleonic upheaval, whose chief preoccupation was either to recover their rights to an independent existence or to achieve their national unity, the conception of world solidarity seemed not only remote, but inconceivable. It was not until the forces of nationalism had succeeded in overthrowing the foundations of the Holy Alliance that had sought to curb their rising power that the possibility of a world order, transcending in its range the political institutions these nations had established, came to be seriously entertained. It was not until after the World War that these exponents of arrogant nationalism came to regard such an order as the object of a pernicious doctrine tending to sap that essential loyalty upon which the continued existence of their national life depended. With a vigour that recalled the energy with which the members of the Holy Alliance sought to stifle the spirit of a rising nationalism among the peoples liberated from the Napoleonic yoke, these champions of an unfettered national sovereignty, in their turn, have laboured and are still labouring to discredit principles upon which their own salvation must ultimately depend. The fierce opposition which greeted the abortive scheme of the Geneva Protocol, the ridicule poured upon the proposal for a United States of Europe, which was subsequently advanced, and the failure of the general scheme for the economic union of Europe may appear as setbacks to the efforts which a handful of foresighted people are earnestly exerting to advance this noble ideal. And yet, are we not justified in deriving fresh encouragement when we observe that the very consideration of such proposals is in itself an evidence of their steady growth in the minds and hearts of men? In the organized attempts that are being made to discredit so exalted a conception, are we not witnessing the repetition, on a larger scale, of those stirring struggles and fierce controversies that preceded the birth and assisted in the reconstruction of the unified nations of the West? The Federation of Mankind. To take but one instance, how confident were the assertions made in the days preceding the unification of the states of the North American continent regarding the insuperable barriers that stood in the way of their ultimate federation? Was it not widely and emphatically declared that the conflicting interests, the mutual distrust, the differences of government and habit that divided the states were such as no force, whether spiritual or temporal, could ever hope to harmonize or control? And yet, how different were the conditions prevailing 150 years ago from those that characterize present-day society? It would indeed be no exaggeration to say that the absence of those facilities which modern scientific progress has placed at the service of humanity in our time made of the problem of welding the American states into a single federation, similar, though they were in certain traditions, a task infinitely more complex than that which confronts a divided humanity in its efforts to achieve the unification of all mankind. Who knows that for so exalted a conception to take shape, a suffering more intense than any it has yet experienced will have to be inflicted upon humanity? Could anything less than the fire of a civil war with all its violence and vicissitudes, a war that nearly rent the great American Republic, have welded the states not only into a union of independent units, but into a nation, in spite of all the ethnic differences that characterized its component parts? That so fundamental a revolution, involving such far-reaching changes in the structure of society, can be achieved through the ordinary processes of diplomacy and education seems highly improbable. We have but to turn our gaze to humanity's blood-stained history to realize that nothing short of intense mental as well as physical agony has been able to precipitate those epoch-making changes that constitute the greatest landmarks in the history of human civilization. The Fire of Ordeal. Great and far-reaching as have been those changes in the past, they cannot appear when viewed in their proper perspective except as subsidiary adjustments precluding that transformation of unparalleled majesty and scope which humanity is in this age bound to undergo. That the forces of a world catastrophe can alone precipitate such a new phase of human thought is, alas, becoming increasingly apparent. That nothing short of the fire of a severe ordeal, unparalleled in its intensity, can fuse and weld the discordant entities that constitute the elements of present-day civilization into the integral components of the world commonwealth of the future is a truth which future events will increasingly demonstrate. The prophetic voice of Baha'u'llah warning in the concluding passages of the Hidden Words, the peoples of the world, that an unforeseen calamity is following them and that grievous retribution awaiteth them, throws indeed a lurid light upon the immediate fortunes of sorrowing humanity. Nothing but a fiery ordeal, out of which humanity will emerge chastened and prepared, can succeed in implanting that sense of responsibility which the leaders of a newborn age must arise to shoulder. I would again direct your attention to those ominous words of Baha'u'llah which I have already quoted. And when the appointed hour is come, there shall suddenly appear that which shall cause the limbs of mankind to quake. Has not Abdu'l-Bahá himself asserted in unequivocal language that another war, fiercer than the last, will assuredly break out? Upon the consummation of this colossal, this unspeakably glorious enterprise, an enterprise that baffled the resources of Roman statesmanship and which Napoleon's desperate efforts failed to achieve, will depend the ultimate realization of that millennium of which poets of all ages have sung and seers have long dreamed. Upon it will depend the fulfillment of the prophecies uttered by the prophets of old, when swords shall be beaten into plowshares, and the lion and the lamb lie down together. It alone can usher in the kingdom of the Heavenly Father, as anticipated by the faith of Jesus Christ. It alone can lay the foundation for the new world order visualized by Baha'u'llah, a world order that shall reflect, however dimly, upon this earthly plane, the ineffable splendors of the Abha Kingdom. One word more in conclusion. The proclamation of the oneness of mankind, the head cornerstone of Baha'u'llah's all-embracing dominion, can under no circumstances be compared with such expressions of pious hope as have been uttered in the past. His is not merely a call which he raised alone and unaided in the face of the relentless and combined opposition of two of the most powerful Oriental potentates of his day, while himself an exile and prisoner in their hands. It implies at once a warning and a promise. A warning that in it lies the sole means for the salvation of a greatly suffering world. A promise that its realization is at hand. Uttered at a time when its possibility had not yet been seriously envisaged in any part of the world, it has, by virtue of that celestial potency which the spirit of Baha'u'llah has breathed into it, come at last to be regarded by an increasing number of thoughtful men, not only as an approaching possibility, but as the necessary outcome of the forces now operating in the world. The mouthpiece of God. Surely the world, contracted and transformed into a single, highly complex organism by the marvelous progress achieved in the realm of physical science, by worldwide expansion of commerce and industry, and struggling under the pressure of world economic forces amidst the pitfalls of a materialistic civilization, stands in dire need of a restatement of the truth underlying all the revelations of the past in a language suited to its essential requirements. And what voice other than that of Baha'u'llah, the mouthpiece of God for this age, is capable of effecting a transformation of society as radical as that which he has already accomplished in the hearts of those men and women so diversified and seemingly irreconcilable who constitute the body of his declared followers throughout the world? That such a mighty conception is fast budding out in the minds of men, that voices are being raised in its support, that its salient features must fast crystallize in the consciousness of those who are in authority, few indeed can doubt. That its modest beginnings have already taken shape in the worldwide administration with which the adherents of the faith of Baha'u'llah stand associated, only those whose hearts are tainted by prejudice can fail to perceive. Ours, dearly beloved co-workers, is the paramount duty to continue with undimmed vision and unabated zeal to assist in the final erection of that edifice, the foundations of which Baha'u'llah has laid in our hearts, to derive added hope and strength from the general trend of recent events, however dark their immediate effects, and to pray with unremitting fervour that he may hasten the approach of the realisation of that wondrous vision which constitutes the brightest emanation of his mind and the fairest fruit of the fairest civilization the world has yet seen. Might not the 100th anniversary of the declaration of the faith of Baha'u'llah mark the inauguration of so vast an era in human history? Your true brother, Shoghi, Haifa, Palestine, November 28th, 1931.